Nous vous demandons encore une fois de bien vouloir fermer vos téléphones cellulaires, s'il vous plaît. Le iPod, le BlackBerry, le truc que vous avez, tout ce qui fait bip, babo, s'il vous plaît, tout fermé. Very happy to invite you back to the second plenary of the day. And as I promised, coming out of this morning's remarks, we have a lot of food for thought already on the table. And the question before this panel is the question that we've heard a lot raised already yesterday in our pre-conference panel, the state of public policy making, through the minister's speech on public policy in crisis, through the address by the clerk of the Privy Council, Kevin Lynch, and also in the panel, which was about evidence, but in which the word crises and what to do in crisis situations was very much in evidence. And the question before us now is whether or not the crises generate bad policy. It's a provocative question, and for those of you who know the Ministry of Study of Canada and who know the chair of this panel, you'll know that provocation is part of the game, I guess. As an associate professor and chair of the Department of Economics here at McGill University, as well as being a very widely read media commentator, Bill Watson is asking himself on a daily basis whether big crises generate bad policy, whether the science of economics does, I don't know, but maybe he'll be able to defend it a little bit while we're here. He's joining me in welcoming Professor William Watson and his panel.
Thank you very much, Antonio. That's very kind of you. I do worry that a big crisis generates too much policy, but we'll see whether it's bad policy. My job is not to provoke, but to be the moderator, so I'm going to try to moderate. But I suspect with this panel there's not too much moderation that's required, but if they have a hand or unruly, we'll attempt to moderate. And the usual rules apply. Everything's public. They have about 10 minutes. I will not... they need no introduction, and so I won't give them an introduction, except for Peter Russell, who hasn't yet appeared at this conference and who has a new book out. Two cheers for minority government. Two cheers is not the maximum number of cheers, but it's a majority of the cheers that are available. And this book is on sale now at the bookstore, but there are hot copies available. There's a young lady back just raising her hand up on the stairs there who will take cash. And I don't know if she charges the GST. I don't know if she's doing so out of principled reasons or not. But anyway, it looks like a terrific read, and I recommend it to you. I would introduce the three as experts, but then Mr. Clark used the term experts. So I'll simply say that there are three people who have deep experience and sophisticated insights about policy, and I'm sure we're going to hear some extremely interesting comments about this question. Mel Kapp is going to go first, and he has a presentation of a technological kind.
Thanks, Bill. Okay. I'm surprised that we've gotten this far in the conversation and we haven't heard the citation of Rahm Emanuel yet. And Jeremy, you give me something again. It would be a shame to waste a good crisis. And that's where the Obama administration is now, and that's how we should think about crises. So I'm going to give, this is the outline of what I'm going to say. Let me start with a brief introduction. This conversation is not about, does bad policy generate crises? It should be. There's a whole other dimension, which is the flip side of the coin, and we can talk about that later. And there's a huge literature about how bad policy creates crises. And I'll touch on some of it as we go. Now, in my world, having been trained as an economist, as I have already demonstrated I am proud of, Ian, and I claim to know a few, the answer to all questions is, it depends. And so I start from that premise, and we'll try to bring evidence to suggest that this is not the case, that crises, big crises do not generate a bad policy. But on the fundamentals, it really does depend. So I wanted to talk about what are the circumstances that lead to bad policy, when do crises generate bad policy, and what are crises, and how would you know if a policy is bad? I want to think about the importance of planning and preparation when there is not a crisis, and how that affects the extent to which bad policy flows. There was a great line that one of my predecessors as clerk of the Privy Council used, Paul Tellier, who now is on the board of IRPP, and Paul talked about how senior officials always have in the bottom drawers of their desks their favorite idea, which will have no traction with ministers. And when the time comes, when there is a crisis, when an opportunity presents itself, it's fundamentally important to reach into that bottom drawer and pull out the good ideas. And so a lot of the responses that we've talked about, that we heard Minister Faraday talk about and that others have talked about, have been because there has been good preparation. for the crisis. We've got to think about that policy for whom and by whose standards. And we've got to think about why some countries respond to the same crisis in a different way. So Sarbanes-Oxley in the U.S. did not have a counterpart in Canada. We did take action on corporate governance in Canada, but in a much more measured pace. And why was that? The Glass-Steagall Act, go back to, what was the good year for the Glass-Steagall Act? So, 1932, sort of in the aftermath of the Depression, or in the middle of the Depression, they decided that it would be verboten to have investment banks held by real banks. And then, when did they get rid of the act? Oh, it was not George W. Bush. It was actually Bill Clinton. Now, he responded to a Democratic bill in the Congress, and we'll come back to that as well. I want to talk a bit about some examples. Yes, I reluctantly admit I will use evidence. Sometimes you need a crisis to generate reform and change in policy. The debt and deficit discussion that we've heard both Kevin Lynch and yesterday Jim Flaherty talk about is really important. And it was a wonderful line, again, I will cite others. We do build on the shoulders of giants. David Dodge, and he was actually the Deputy Minister of Finance before he was Governor of the Bank, had this wonderful line where he said, when the pattern of the brickwork on the wall you're about to hit becomes clear, you're forced to take action. And so it requires a crisis in some respects to actually get to the point where you're going to take action. Now, there is lots of literature on the crisis, and most of it is about how it generates superficial reform rather than fundamental reform. But consider the October 1995 near-death experience of the referendum in Quebec. And Prime Minister Chrétien invited Pierre Pettigrew and Stéphane Dion into cabinet. And following that, the development of the Clarity Act, which was then introduced in 1999, arguably a bad piece of policy. I think, I remember clearly, Ian was right not to cite officials, advise ministers. I would advise, tell you what I advised. I said that don't sleepy dogs. Things are quiet now in this post-referendum period. This would be a bad piece of initiative. Having said that, the government proceeded with it, and I think it was actually a clever response to a crisis. In the 9/11 case, we've seen the thickening of the border. I remind you about anthrax, which we had, and we took action with C-36, the Anti-Terrorism Act. I want to. There are a couple of citations here. One of them is 9/11 and its aftermath by Crotty, where he looks at George W. Bush's response and Kennedy's response to crisis in Cuba, where he finds that Kennedy consulted widely among people he didn't trust and came to a judgment. George W. Bush listened to people who he only trusted and did not necessarily respond as well as might have been required. In the C-36 case, the government created a cabinet committee. Now, Chrétien was loath to create cabinet committees. He had two. Against my best advice, again, I'm disclosing all my secrets here, he would not create an international affairs committee, but he did create an anti-terrorism committee. And the decision of that group, which looked at how to structure the legislation on anti-terrorism, was interesting. The process was deliberative. We brought together ministers with diverse opinions and different regional base. And Deputy Minister of Justice was the only other official at the table. And considering the protection of human rights was absolutely essential in that process, and so the process was fundamentally important. And again, just a couple of clever titles for books in the field. There's a wonderful book called The Security of Freedom, which came out. It was a number of lawyers at the University of Toronto and elsewhere, and there's a wonderful article in this book called by Diesenhaus, which it calls The Permanence of the Temporary, Can Emergency Powers Be Normalized? Think about the move from the War Measures Act to the Emergency Act and how that was done in a period not of crisis, preparing for the treatment of a crisis. We used the War Measures Act when we needed it, arguably, but we needed to form the act in order to be prepared for the future. A number of other issues I won't deal with. A clear in the financial meltdown current situation, a clear danger of over-regulation. I go back to Sarbox, where Canada took care and didn't over-regulate. My lesson taken from the United States in this is where they have increased stimulus and want to then re-regulate by the European view, regulate and then take the stimulus. If we learn anything from TARP, the toxic assets recovery program and the subsequent actions go big and go often. What the Americans are doing with their stimulus package is remarkable. So let me cite, just to show that I can cite Rahm Emanuel and Don Rumsfeld in the same talk. Rumsfeld talked about knowing your known unknowns. And this treatment of uncertainty that Kevin Lind raised, I think, is really crucial. And we need to think about those things for which we can use probability distributions and those things that we cannot. On the clawback performance pay, I'll just note that retroactive breaking of contracts is not usually a good idea. You may not like the contract when it was struck, or ex post, you may not like the contract that was struck ex ante, but it will have profound effects on the ability of governments to attract good people into the financial sector when they think that the incentive is gone. A few other examples, and we could go on and on. I should tell you that when I first sent this over to Miss, it said the sponsorship scandal. I promised myself I would never call that a scandal, and so thank you to Adrienne for removing it. Y2K. Y2K was fundamentally important in 9/11. People don't appreciate how important it was for government to plan for a crisis that didn't happen. And then when the crisis does happen, as Kevin described, 239 wide-body jets coming across oceans, landing in Canada, as we were unprepared for it, well, we were actually more prepared than not. And we were more prepared because we had planned for Y2K and were prepared for the unpredictable. And the sponsorship issue, clearly made the government incapable of taking action. Now we are incapable of attracting good staffers, difficult for legitimate programs to deal with grants and contributions. En ce qui concerne les critères pour éviter les mauvaises décisions, j'aimerais souligner les choses qui n'ont pas de précédent, par exemple. Donc, quand on parle de Y2K, we're talking about a situation that never happened before. How do you prepare for something that you have no basis on which to deal with? Also, how do you deal with something where no one has a memory of how we dealt with something? Now, good luck to us that Ben Bernanke actually studied the Depression and that on balance he's taking some of those lessons and using them, not maybe as well as his successors will look to. He's studied his actions. En ce qui concerne les questions de planification dont j'ai déjà parlé, j'aimerais parler aussi de les planifications et préparations qu'on a faites après 1999, quand il y avait le problème de Rassam. Remember, Ahmed Rassam was going into the United States to blow up LAX. That had affected the border. We realized then that we were going to have a smart border. When 9/11 happened and the border closed down, we were prepared with our ideas for a smart border. And that was absolutely essential. I'll talk about a structured and disciplined process for decision-making, and Wendy talked about COBRA. The United Kingdom uses this term brilliantly. The Cabinet Office Briefing Room A. I've been in COBRA. It is a brilliant facility. It actually doesn't matter what goes on in there. What matters is the public takes comfort. When the Prime Minister chaired a cabinet committee in COBRA, and the public thinks that everything's under control as a result. So that is very important. We've talked about evidence and analysis. I'm going. So what are my three lessons? I have three lessons. It's P-Cube. If it doesn't have an acronym, it doesn't exist. People. Calm, thoughtful, and listening. Jim Flaherty's comment and Bill Clark referred to it again this morning. The ability to listen, to understand, take divergent views, assimilate them, think of them, that's absolutely crucial. The openness to evidence, the ability to consult for people who have no hidden agendas, and bringing diverse views to bear. In federal-provincial relations, and Matthew manifests an atypical sense of country when he talks about this is a former deputy minister of intergovernmental affairs in a province. Not always nice to him. But again, in federal-provincial relations, the most important investment I had made as clerk was the several meetings I'd had with all the provincial secretaries of cabinet. Because when 9/11 hit and I needed to them to pick up the phone and take action, they answered my call, and that was crucial. Process. It has to be a deliberative process. This is where you get to this balance between speed and certainty. It's never going to be exactly right. You're always going to be struggling with it. But deliberative is crucial. Bring diverse views into the room and an optimal decisiveness. Finally, Parliament. And this was written before Joe Clark's comments, but I enjoyed them very much. I think Parliament has a huge role to play, but it hasn't found its role yet. And minority government, contrary to what you'll hear in a few minutes from Professor Russell, I think is an impediment. But there is hope in the committee structure, in the Library of Parliament, which supports the parliamentary committee. I am a big fan of experts. I make no apologies. I think parliamentary committees can play a very valuable role in bringing experts into Parliament in order to inform the debate. Having said that, there are two publications I draw your attention to at the most important website you'll hear in this conference, www.irpp.org. One by Kent Roche, a legal scholar at the University of Toronto, better late than never, the Canadian Parliamentary Review of the Anti-Terrorism Act 2007. There he looks at the process that was used in the three-year review of the Anti-Terrorism Act and finds a House of Commons terribly wanting and the Senate modestly wanted in its ability to deal with this, and extraordinarily partisan in the way it played, to the point where the proponents of preventive detention and investigative hearings voted not to renew the provisions, and it's a bizarre situation. Another document is by Greg Forsizzi, who is a legal scholar at the University of Ottawa, called Fixing Deficiencies in Parliamentary Review Anti-Terrorism Law. And he cites the UK and Australian example, where there is an expert, in this case, in the UK, Lord Carlisle, who is actually a Liberal Democrat of the third party sitting in the Lords, who actually provides a written analytic review of all anti-terrorism legislation before Parliament considers what to do. And it's a very clever way of proceeding. So in conclusion, my conclusion is big crises do not necessarily generate bad policy. With right people, processes, and parliamentary engagement, crises can make for good policy. Thank you.
Thank you, Mel. Quiar is next.
Thank you. Good day to all. Is this working? Yes. Of this crisis, make that policy not necessarily as we just heard. I don't intend today to offer a generic answer to this, but I'll draw from my real life experiences to tell you a little bit about this topic. 5 years there. You know, we heard the citation from Rahm Emanuel. There's another one I like very much. It's from Hamane, one of the founders of the European Union, who said in the 50s that humans only change when necessity arises and only perceive necessity in times of crisis. I think it remains very true today. We heard as well from Melanie, he's totally right, that ISIS could come from bad policy, but it can also come from no policy, when a problem has been ignored, or left in the dark, or left aside in the bottom drawer, as you say. There's one professional analogy from my previous professional life I'd like to tell you about briefly, before getting in deeper in the matter. I used to be a surgeon, as you probably know, and operate on brain aneurysm, little balloons in your arteries that can rupture, and of course present significant challenges. And what can happen when you operate on these is that they will rupture before you have a chance to deal with them. And it creates a very, very problematic, as you can imagine, situation. But what I learned from my professor and my professional experience is what puts the patient at risk is not the rupture, it's the surgeon's reaction to the rupture that will decide the fate of the patient. And I always remember that. So I'd like to share with you three real-life cases that I encountered during my time in politics. But before, maybe a few important principles. Sometimes the media will create a perception of crisis where, in fact, there is not, is the first question to ask yourself. And I think continuous news coverage can do this quite easily. So in such a circumstance, you have to face the challenge of diffusing deception that there is a crisis. You always fail with this, but you have to persist, and it takes time, but you succeed. If there is actually no crisis, only your perception of it, you get there. But what you get also is titled in the next paper, which I could predict always with my name on, we are se faire rassurant, meaning in English, we have tries to reassure, but you know what it means. So communication is very important, but not only in a short, medium perspective. And governments remember early in the initial battles. Because when the crisis involves public services, elected officials and public servants face a huge credibility gap. The only exception I saw in this is public health officials, who are perceived as physician professionals and listened by the public. I think this is where universities, banks, and groups like this one can play a big role by putting the situation in context and bringing a different perspective. We also have to realize that there are different categories of crisis, and just heard Mel talk about this. The first would be a pre-existing known phenomenon up to be under control, that suddenly becomes a major issue or a major problem. That's one example. Second example would be a problem that's been there all along, but remain in bottom drawer. It's people know it exists, you know, we'll deal with this eventually, and basically won't deal with it, and then you get in trouble. Or third, on a completely new and unexpected situation,
So I have an example of each of the three, and maybe we can base a discussion on this later. The first category, which is a false impression of control, is the C-diff outburst in 2004. You're not, of course, physicians. Hospital-acquired infections are a known phenomenon in healthcare institutions. But we had then a major public health crisis that severely affected the lives of hundreds of Quebecers, even cost them their lives, and, of course, trust in the safe public institutions. They are expected to be there because the patient population changes, there is widespread use of cross-spectrum antibiotics, so you can't get rid of the phenomenon. And up to a certain level, you have to accept that it exists. So in 2004, and in 2003, there was not a pandemic, it would not respond to that definition, but we had the same situation simultaneously in UK, Holland, and Northeastern North America, but in Quebec, it became a major issue. What happened was a mutation to a new, more virulent strain, widespread, again, use of broad-spectrum antibiotics, no monitoring of the situation in real time, only afterwards, a year or two later, you get statistics from hospitals. A significant drop in hygiene standards, probably dating from the deeper cuts at the end of the 90s. No action plan was ever put in place. No coordinated prevention efforts. And hindsight, of course, the retrospectoscope, as you used to say, is the best instrument you can use in public policy analysis. In hindsight, just a crisis waiting to happen. So this is how it came with an explosion of the media in the summer of 2004. I did the big communication mistake at the beginning of the crisis I want to share with you. Because of my background as a physician, I assumed that the public shared my basic knowledge about the problem. I know that hospital-acquired infection exists. I know that it's always been there. I know that it costs a lot of patients every year in Canada, will always be there. But the public learned of the existence of this when crisis erupted. And I was not at all in sync with the level of knowledge and understanding of the public when I initially commented on this, which actually made the matter worse. But the result of the crisis was that we finally implemented all the things that may have prevented the crisis, a surveillance program that is now done in other provinces, prevention nurses in hospitals, etc., and a true action plan. So this is an example of a pre-existing known phenomenon suddenly explodes in your face. The second category, which is the bottom drawer problem, or the so-called dark room situation, is the abuse of dependent seniors in nursing homes, and was a big scandal in 2003. Those who are from Quebec will remember the Saint-Charles-Borromée case, where a tape recorder was put in the room of a patient and was basically revealed significant abuse, initially downplayed by his institution, which made it worse. And again, this time, it was useful to, of course, unfortunately, for the people who suffered from it at the time, but for future persons, proper policies were put in place, notably inspection of nursing homes, both public and private. The third category, I think you find interesting, a totally new phenomenon, is the shadowy ruling. Why do I say it's a new phenomenon? Because this is part of the healthcare problem in healthcare in Canada. Nobody expected the ruling to be what it was in the hours preceding the ruling. What I learned after that is when lawyers tell you there will be a problem, beware. You know, there's going to be a problem. So we were faced with a ruling that severely threatened the foundations of the Canadian healthcare system with basically no preparation to it, even in the top bottom drawer of government. Because it had become belief in Canada and in Quebec, no different, that this could not happen, that tribunals would always uphold the orthodox or the way the healthcare system works. Fortunately, this was used to put in place a major policy initiative, which, by the way, was designed at protecting the values of the system, improve access through transformation, which is Bill 33, which I think with the passage of time will be seen as an elaborate defense of values and a step forward in improving access to care. Interestingly, a part of that bill makes it compulsory for hospitals to measure the waiting list and take care of the waiting list and manage it actively. It's strange that you would have to legislate for the hospitals to do that. But I'm not sure, had there not been a Shaoli case, had there not been a ruling, I'm not sure I would have had then the authority to do this and other things. So then it created an opportunity. So what are the determinants of what happens after a crisis? I would say the abilities and attitudes of the decision makers to diagnose the problem and its causes correctly, see a crisis as a window opportunity, mobilize the organization and provide leadership, and resist becoming a participant in the media frenzy of the first days. Because this is what you get. The whole communication and public media aspect of crisis is a subject on its own. And if you are drawn into this, you will fail. So remain silent or semi-silent for as long as possible. Saying things like, you know, I still have to think about it before I come to a conclusion. This is never popular with the media. Because they will put this quote on tea at night and you really look stupid. But you think about it, this is the right thing to say. This is very complex. I need to take time about it before I come to a conclusion. And there's always, in the surrounding media atmosphere, the prophet of doom. There's always one prophet of doom somewhere who is announcing the end of civilization as we know it. and this person is very popular with the media, and it's very hard, and it's very hard to contradict that person. And I have a few that mind, which will leave for the moment. So how can public policy research, public service help? I would say it's like medicine, prevention. And essential, and public service should not expect ministers when they come into office that after they are sworn in to tell them, look, Mr. Deputy or Madam Deputy Minister, could you please give a list of what could happen in the next 3 or 4 years and what we should do? It doesn't happen. So we expect, and we have a very competent public service in Canada and in the provinces, that prevention is part of the culture also, and you get ready for the crisis that you see. But sometimes you don't see it coming, but it's not the majority. The majority of the crisis we see, of course, 9/11 is a special case, Shaoli ruling, but the majority of the cases are things that existed, that become worse, or things that were ignored. Be the voice of reason, avoid the under, because underreaction and overreaction can be dangerous in a crisis situation. Provide international perspective. Resist entropy. Entropy is a tendency for any system to disintegrate if you don't have a constant agreement. So once you have an crisis and there's a media flurry, the media reaction is in crisis itself, and you pass this and you survive politically, then there's a tendency not to apply energy anymore to the problem and let go. And it's even worse, let me tell you, a recurring or apparently unresolved problem coming back a few months down the line is much worse sometimes than the initial crisis. So that's basically what I wanted to communicate with you, a few real-life examples. And again, the importance of giving an idea of what type of crisis you're dealing with, and also the importance of prevention from the public service and the think tanks. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Peter Russell.
Thank you very much, Abel, and thank you, Antonia, and others for inviting me back. I enjoy coming here. It's an unusual topic for me to address. I'm going to talk about the parliamentary crisis that we seem to have had beginning last November the 27th and running roughly to the end of January. And I can't resist telling you, if you want to know more about it and have forgotten, 2 days ago, a book edited by myself and my colleague Lauren Sawson called Parliamentary Democracy in Crisis. That 14 articles that began to be written on December the 5th, and the students who are eminent constitutional experts from across the country had to have their papers in by February the 6th. So we could publish this on March the 24th, the University of Toronto Press, in record time. And I want to say that because that book on security and freedom was in the same way, and we keep hearing, why can't press get books out fast? Well, we got that in crises, University of Toronto Press. So it's not at your bookstore yet. Another book that I'm shamelessly is, and I'll talk about it, and I hope that maybe even Mel Capp might take the trouble to read it, although if he has, it's an evidence-based discussion of minority government, and there's quite a bit of evidence to contradict what he just told you. But I want to talk about two kinds of policy in this recent crisis. One was the fiscal economic policy to deal with this terrible fiscal meltdown and oncoming economic recession. And the other is a policy to deal with parliamentary government, particularly the policy of how to govern effectively with minority parliaments. And my thesis, very simply, is that the crisis that we've had may have just gone through may have improved the first kind of policy, the fiscal, economic, budgetary policy, but produced very bad results in terms of parliamentary policy. The fiscal, economic policy presented to the House of Commons by Minister Farty on November the 27th. He didn't have a whole lot to say about it yesterday, that particular policy. I'm no expert, but it did look like very good policy. It was a sudden switch of his own government's general position on the issues. It was not discussed, so far as I know, and certainly I don't think people in the caucus side me, with his own caucus. I have no evidence, and I don't think it was discussed with Cabinet. That's a good way to make policy. It had provocative bells and whistles that had almost nothing to do with the fiscal outlook, taking the right pay for public servants, taking the right of women to appeal decisions on pay equity and the financing of the $27 million that goes into financing political parties with a budget of $275 billion, hardly designed to do anything with the economic crisis. The budget that was presented and adopted at the end of January, supported by the Liberals, and adopted the budget information bill in record time in a minority parliament in 45 days, this impediment to good government. The fastest it's ever been done, but the debate, and there'll be continuing debate, it was a better budget and a better economic policy. The crisis improved the policy in that area. What about the parliamentary policy? There are three parts to what I want to say about it. One is prorogation. Isn't that interesting? I mean, what a word. Have you ever talked about prorogation before December the 4th when Stephen Harper asked the Governor General to prorogue? I certainly didn't. The rules and conventions of parliamentary government and the policy role of parliament, and just to amplify a little bit of what Joe Clark said, prorogation in the decision to grant it, the Governor General made on the 4th of December. In terms of principle, it's a difficult one to defend because granting a request to suspend the proceedings of Parliament and not just have a new Parliament come on sometime later, just in order to avoid a non-confidence vote. A non-confidence vote is crucial. You get your license to govern in parliamentary democracy by having the confidence of those of Commons. And to ask to prorogue Parliament because you're afraid of losing such a vote goes against that fundamental principle of parliamentary democracy. The sitting grist, however, is that on the other side, the Governor General, to tell you this much, made it very clear that she could say no and retains that power to say no. She was also promised, as Prime Minister Harper explained to the public when he came out of Rideau Hall, she was assured that Parliament would come back at the end of January, about 5.5 weeks' time, and there would be an opportunity to have confidence in the government. And most importantly, he would now, with Minister of Finance and Public Service, work on a good and better financial fiscal budget policy, working both with the opposition, which he did, and closely with the Americans and the Obama regime, whose input would be very important in developing Canada's policy. There you go on prorogation. It's kind of a draw. There are good policy reasons for grant prorogation. I put it this way because I choose my words carefully. If she said no, and she could say no, I personally wish, and I hope on future occasions, she gives at least as many written reasons or as extensive as Prime Minister, as Governor General Kerr in Australia did when he explained his decision to dismiss Prime Minister Whitlam. There is no convention that bans the Governor General giving his or her reasons for a decision. But if she'd said no, we would have had a government led by Stephan Dion and with the in coalition with the NDP, and supported by the Bloc. Now I can hear the silence in the room. I personally think that would have been a terrific government. But I'm one person, and I know that government would have been attacked as virtually no government has been attacked in the past. We already know the outgoing government would call it a coup d'etat. And that government has terrific support, that conservative government, in much of the country, particularly the west of the country. There would have been a crisis of legitimacy that we've virtually never known in Canadian government. You could say that's mean, bad, but that's reality. And have that kind of crisis in the middle, kind of political crisis, in the middle of the economic crisis we were in, personally, thinking of the people whose jobs, whose day-to-day economic security and welfare depend so much on having that economic crisis, I think there's a lot of maybe policy reasons why the decision in the end was the correct one. Well, let me get to the part of the policy on Parliament that I'm most concerned with, and that's the rules. The rules, the unwritten rules that govern the power of the Governor General, they're normally just to do whatever the Prime Minister asks, but the unwritten rules that govern the reserve powers of the Governor General in a modern parliamentary democracy. The first thing you should all, and I hope you agree with me, these rules, like you knew, they're not written down. You won't find them in the Constitution Act. They depend on a political consensus in the country and develop through political consensus. I hit that point because on November the 27th, as the coalition raised to the Conservatives its ugly head, Prime Minister Harper announced three as far as I know, brand new rules governing parliamentary government. They were as follows. First of all, Prime Minister is directly elected in the election. The election doesn't matter to Parliament. It determines who the Prime Minister will be. And who is that? It's the leader of the party with the most seats. Not a majority. Most seats in the House of Commons. That's it. Rule number two, sort of a corollary at first, is you can't change the Prime Minister across party without another election. That's a brand new baby in the world of parliamentary democracy. And number three, you can't have a coalition unless it's for the public before the election and approved, and it has to be approved by having its leader, following the first two rules, the leader of the coalition would have to win the popularity contest in the election, since the people directly elect the Prime Minister. Now, I don't need to tell you that most of us who spent good chunks of our life teaching the unwritten part of the Constitution, drawing on Jim Mallory from this university, McGregor Dawson, Eugene Forsey, and many others, we'd never heard these rules. A group of 35 of us published what we thought the rules were in January, Le Devoir, and Toronto Star, January the 23rd. The Parliament determines who governs. You elect a parliamentary election, and the Governor General can as a commission of new government across party lines, and coalitions do not need prior approval. Now, here's the point. It's no point. Not in good shape if it's just Peter Russell and 35 constitutional experts saying this, and the Prime Minister and his party, and let me add, many people support what he said. 51% who looked at the Dominion Institute poll in December 14th say, yes, we directly elect the Prime Minister. They believe that. That's a very unhealthy situation to be in when, remember my point, you need a consensus on the conventions of the Constitution. I think certainly a consensus among the political leaders, and I mean the leaders of political parties. I think also you really need a pretty broad consensus at the public level, and we don't have that. Now, some people, when I say this, oh, forget it, Mr. Harper just was having a bad day. I heard, you know, got a bad tummy coming back from Peru, and he was in a bad mood. Maybe that's it, but who work in this area are going to have to spend some time now trying to sort out what the Prime Minister and, I pause, Mr. Lynch has gone, those who advise him, both in government and in his party, what they really think. Because this type of situation is likely to happen again. Our friend, Mr. Kapp, doesn't think much of minority parliaments. Well, we elected one in 2004, 2006, 2008. The Harper government came 37.6% of the seats. If he thinks that someone's going to pull off a majority, let's make a bet. In other words, we've got a minority parliament now, whether you think it's an impediment or not, and we're going to have more, and these situations are going to reoccur. And the Governor General is going to be called upon to make a decision on rules of parliamentary democracy, like an umpire, a referee in a hockey game, and the players don't agree on the rules. Now, Philip talked about shrugging and letting crisis go away. I'm not prepared to let this one go. I'm telling you, this is a black cloud hanging over the parliamentary system of Canada. And our fiscal system, Mr. Lynch, may be very sound. Our parliamentary system, its underlying structure, principles, agreed upon principles, is very, very weak. And we Canadians are in bad shape because of that. Now, my final point is Parliament's role in policy making. Thank God Joe said he did. And I talk about that, the Caps and Lynches, the Nick Franks, most of my friends are parliamentary governors. That's very nice. That isn't the way it works. Don't you know you have a government and you have a government in waiting? And it's just an adversarial process. You don't make policy in committees. Policy is made, first of all, in the civil service, and it's massaged and sold to the PMO. And Parliament is not a policy maker. I think we need a revolution. And I mean a Clark. I'll call it the Joe Clark Revolution. We've got to change that model, because when you only have a minority of the people supporting you, and most Canadians have supported other parties, just to be democratic, You have to have some policy making going on committees. You must reach out. The mathematics of minority parliaments require that. If you've got 142 seats and there's 308, you've got to reach out, make policy more inclusive. And you do that in committees, and committees have to grapple with the policy issues. And it isn't just the government that's kind of stuck into the old view. It's always the liberals. Let me just give you a recent quote from David McGinty about his boss, Michael Ignatieff. I'm glad it isn't from Michael himself. But here's what David said to the Ottawa Hills Times just a couple weeks ago. He said, in this minority parliament, I quote, Mr. Ignatieff's strategy will be on enforcing the government's probation rather than proposing policy ideas that can be stolen by the Tories. We surely had enough of that. Mr. Ignatieff has got some good policy ideas, and I happen to think he has, in the area of the importance of science and technology, and in access to unemployment insurance, and a number of areas that could improve the policies that we're following now. They should be discussed in parliament committees. He should bring them forward. I saw a little bit of this beginning of this morning on CPAC. If you're watching the Standing Committee of Finance taking evidence from a very interesting cross-section of experts, we've got to see a lot more of that parliament and bury the myth. Overcome the myth that parliament has no role in policymaking, and overcome that disconnect that Joe spoke so eloquently about, that disconnect that people think you're sending MPs there to help govern the country. Whereas what we're taught, and what I was taught by the Justice of France, I think I see Michael Atkinson there, I think it's also in his book, but he's less enthusiastic about the traditional model, is that Parliament is just there to show the public there is another option which they'll vote on in the next election. And do we, in closing thought, do we really want an election 204, 206, 208? Last night, Pastor Manbridge asked us, panel, are we going to have one this spring? I mean, they all assume, well, of course, we'll have one by 2010. You know, Iggy and Stephen are going to duke it out, and won't they? That's terrific. They're going to duke it out, and what happened? Another minority parliament, the one we elected on October the 14th. We follow one law case. We have fixed election date legislation that's been abandoned by the government, but introduced it and defended it ably on principle. Abandoned it on September the 7th, when the Prime Minister to see the Governor General, gave no written reason for the election. We've got to be sure the Bill C-16 is still there. I'm of the law case initiated by Democracy Watch to say the request for an election on September the 7th was unconstitutional because it took place in a situation where the government had not been defeated on vote of confidence. And we're hoping for a declaratory judgment. So I close by saying I hope that this crisis we've been through is a wake-up call to improve our policy with regard to parliamentary government. Thank you very much.
During the question period, we can get Peter clear up all the ambiguity in his, what he was saying. Please signal your desire to ask questions, and the keepers of the microphones will come. Please identify yourself as well. You may not touch the microphone.
Sorry, right, the microphone. My name is Pat Alzheimer. I'm probably working in the media relations office here at McGill, so I get to come to these for free. My question is for Dr. Russell. Well, first, a comment, I suppose, vive la révolution. I think that if Parliament is liquor policy, we're all in some trouble. But my question is about these unwritten constitutional rules, the ones you named, and I'm thinking also of the new everything's a confidence motion idea. Is time, and I recognize the process would be long and arduous and difficult, but is it time to write these rules down?
Am I on here?
Yes, sir.
It's certainly time to look very carefully at that. After a very controversial decision of Governor General Kerr in Australia, Australia worked about 12 years on a process of writing some of them down. A process that pretty well has to begin with academics. Right now, it went to Mr. Harper or Mr. Native or Leighton or Zeppelin, said, you got some time, they wouldn't. But not so long after the academics start working on this possibility, researching how it could be done, we have to get politicians involved. because again, it's agreement among the political actors to use the language of a few court decisions that describe how conventions are developed. You must have that consensus. And I think it's time we looked very carefully at your question and came up with a, we might come to the conclusion that it's impossible. I think more likely we might say it could be done, and here's the process, and then begin to try to find some political support for it. But I think we have to do the academic side of this going fairly soon.
Over in the corner.
Thank you. I'm Michael Atkinson from the University of Saskatchewan. Peter, I really enjoyed your comments, and I guess I would just like to an observation that I think follows from them, and that is that if, as I think is the case, and you've made it very well, that minority governments are in our future. We've learned a little bit, maybe a lot, from this last crisis. We've learned about what Canadians don't understand about the constitutional system, and you and your colleagues have helped to clarify that. But I think we're going to have to learn a few more things, including this, that coalition governments are probably in our future if we expect governments, the way we understand it within the Westminster model, to continue to work. To operate the way we have with a government based on 100% of the electorate and simply presuming to hold all of the power by virtue of that, and then to have Parliament engaged the way you want it to be engaged, Peter, that doesn't work, I don't think, long-term if you cannot imagine inviting other political parties to share in the governing process. It's not something we have any experience with, but we better get used to it if we expect Parliament to work the way I think you want to work, and I do too.
Is there a question there? You want to, Peter? Do you want?
I guess I'm looking for an affirmation or.
Okay, that's fine. That's been, I must say,
I agree with Michael.
Well, it's so wonderful these days to be talking about constitutional matters again. You know, it's so comforting that after 6 months of economic crisis, Mel, do you want to say something?
Well, just I think Mike's raised the point properly, which is that we don't have political tradition or political culture of this. We've had one, as far as I know, one coalition government, and it was during the war, the first war. And until we develop, so I agree with Peter there, we will be living with minority governments for the next decade, I suspect. And we will, maybe that's the way we develop that political culture and tradition, but I'll tell you, it will be a very painful process. And I don't want to have to actually learn those lessons during a major crisis.
Good. Absolutely right. That's why. Let's get going on it.
My name is Sharon Ensign-Sear, and I'm the president of the Canadian Policy Research Network, and I, too, very much to be here, but want to come back to you, Peter. I've been spending quite a time in Newfoundland and Labrador recently, and it reminded me very much of my friend Rick Mercer's rant on the responsibilities of citizenship. And as a matter of fact, in his rant, he said, you know, people have to get a license in order to drive, but you need to know anything to vote. And in fact, you know, the prime minister is not elected by the public, and the party can switch, and in fact, a coalition is not coup d'etat. And so he made those points. I think he might have taken a little instruction from you, clearly, but I don't think he was dispassionate. But I think that this was not a crisis. It was indeed predictable. And some work that we've done with respect to young people and their voting behavior and their participation in the Canadian politics, I think concluded, we looked at this issue quite substantively with six different papers and a summary paper, which is called Lost in Translation. And looking at the involvement of young people in political parties and their exclusion, the fact that the agenda for federal government have not spoken directly to youth, and clearly their lack of participation in the electorate. And one of the conclusions that we drew was that there is no longer mandatory courses in civics in classrooms across this country. We've lost the mandatory teaching of civics in grade 10, which used to be, in fact, a real public right in terms of that. And I think that that is to the detriment. And clearly, we've lost common knowledge around our parliamentary democracy. And so I'd really like to hear from everyone about what we're going to do to rectify the lack of common knowledge around what it is to be a citizen of Canada.
I totally agree. And the program that I'm involved in, and Mark, all of us should know about it and support it, is called the Teachers Institute. It was began and is based in the Parliamentary Library in Ottawa, and it brings teachers to Ottawa, mostly grade 10 teachers, although I've seen ones there who are teaching at the senior levels of elementary school, and it gives them a week in Parliament. They learn a lot, and they go back, and they have workshops in the regions. Can only bring so far 72 a year.
I'm involved as a chairman, or former chair, now as chair of the Churchill Society, wait for it, for the Advancement of Parliamentary Democracy. We fund the teachers to go there because a lot of them, the school board says, yes, you can go, but we need a substitute teacher. And so we come to the rescue and pay for the substitute teacher and even for travel expenses if you know, if that's necessary. And they, with that are some development of some new materials for teaching parliament democracy in the schools. And in basically in civics classes in grade 10. They're not mandatory, but they're pretty big. We can't do anything about making them mandatory. We can't go to the 10 provincial governments and change their curriculum. But we're providing some better materials. The first bulletin is just coming off the press. Well, I'm not involved, but I've been involved in making it. It's really for English as a second language training. It's to address an immediate crisis. I talked to a grade 10 student from an Edmonton school, and he also brings students to Ottawa. In his beginning of grade 10, he said, it wasn't that annoying what parliamentary government is, Professor Russell. What's democracy? And he hadn't been brought up here. He'd arrived rather recently, so he got a tremendous educational challenge there. And Google the Teachers Institute on the computer. We're always looking for more help. And we need to have much more of the workshops in local areas. 72 teachers a year, it's our sixth year, is just a drop in the bucket. They've got to go back, and we've got to support their work and professional development days in every community of Canada.
Tonya?
I can't resist. Question for Couillard. First question to Couillard is, you've lived through minority government in Quebec, briefly, so maybe I'd like you to have comments on how you felt constrained, what this meant to you as a minister in the Quebec government. My second question is about the Shaoli situation or crisis. If you go back to the like in June when the Shaoli decision came down in 2005, on Monday there was an announcement that the court would have a decision on Thursday. Court watchers started calling me and saying, we're expecting a decision. You know, it looks like it might be controversial. The court watchers were all buzzing about what was going to happen. On Tuesday, I called a producer at CBC and said, is the Shaoli decision coming out? And the producer said, how do you spell that, Shaoli? Because nobody knew what was going on. But surely, as a minister, Minister of Health, the Minister of Justice, you must know wasn't there any sense that it could have gone either way? Wasn't there any sense of having to prepare the terrain for whatever the eventual decision would be?
The short answer to this is unfortunately not a lot. But let me go back a little bit to what we heard before, and then I'll go specifically to your points. This question of teaching kids civic lessons, I think, is very important. I lived abroad in the 90s, and my kids were in a U.S.-type school, and I was struck by the depth of knowledge they acquired in how government works. The other one, when I heard some comments, a kind of political yellow light started in my head. Let's be careful to assume that the problem is that people don't understand what parliamentary democracy is and give them this message. Maybe they don't want that. Maybe they want another type of government. This is what should be discussing with them. It never works when the message is, you don't understand, you know, we're going to explain, and then you'll be on the right side of the force. A bit of caution here. Now, coming back to your questions, Antonio, I personally enjoyed a minority government. I enjoyed that. I found my work was of a higher quality, I must say. Because, you know, in general, we legislate much too fast in some instances. And the fact that I had to develop my policy before even submitting a memo to the cabinet about a bill, that I had to meet with my two opposition critics, one might say we'll do this even in a majority government, but in real life it does not happen. The fact that I had to do this, the fact that I had to brief them, and again it should be okay, but I hadn't briefed by the civil servants of the ministry of each of the bills I introduced, at the end of the day, produce a much higher quality of legislative work. This is my only... I'm not saying that I'm saying the whole truth here or the whole reality. Maybe I'm wrong, and I've got experts here who are much more knowledgeable than I am in this. But I would say, in 5 years of politics, the highest quality of parliamentary work and the highest quality of legislative work that I witnessed or took part of was during the time of the minority government. The second question about the Shaoli ruling, you raised a very interesting question, which is mainly related to the decision of the healthcare debate in Canada. I will be very frank with you. No one accepted the ruling to be what it was. And I think it's part of the problem in the healthcare debate in Canada. Because, look, what is the theme of the ruling? private health care. Essentially, this is what the court was ruling upon. But we have had the habit of saying, well,
private health care does not exist. It's not here. We don't want it. It's not good. It's bad. It's not bad.
So when you do this, you ignore it, and it becomes a kind of unregulated, kind of black market type of environment. And of course, we are sure the tribunal is going to uphold the system as it is because it's the best system in the world. This is what it was. In fact, you're right. Court experts or the court watchers presumably had had prior warnings or impression that the ruling would not be what it was. Again, it was a shock. I'm afraid I have to confess that it was totally unexpected, at least in government circles.
Hello, my name is Mary Powell. I'd like to thank Monsieur Kua for tous ses commentaires. C'est très intéressant. My question is, I suppose, directed to Professor Russell. I suppose that in one sense, I agree with your concerns about new rules that Stephen Harper has enunciated. But I wonder two things. One, Stephen Harper has a particular personality. Maybe it's just it's off. It's one guy who is a bit of a bully, and an excellent politician in his own way, but I think highly regarded for his strategic insight in his party. And I think his strategic failures on November 27th have cost him dearly. And it has been suggested that this will be his last, kick in the can. I am not privy to such information. So there is a broader question about parliamentary democracy and what we ought to do about it, perhaps not focusing so much on the alleged new rules enunciated in Harper. But the broader question that relates to minority government raises the issue that I haven't heard anyone talk about, what I would call the Donald Smiley question, which is that to the extent we have minority governments at the federal level and also at the provincial level, they can be made to work, which is why I thought Minister Kua's commentary was so interesting. But what happens when you have a minority government at the federal level making arrangements with provincial governments, some of which may be in minority positions? What happens then to democratic representation? We have a government elected 37% of the people representing the country, and a government elected by 35% of the people from maybe more than one province. Who speaks for the majority? They enter into binding agreements. They don't act to parliament to have them ratified. The minority speaks to the minority, speaks to the majority, and there we have an absence of a democratic partnership.
Anybody care to comment on that?
I agree with your analysis. It's very worrying when you have a minority government that enters into a binding. That's I think there's going to be a workshop at the law school this afternoon on whether these being how binding they are with provinces, which represents as Mary has said a third of Canadians. But I think, again, it's an advertisement for using much more interparliamentary aspects and just executive aspects of our intergovernmental relations. We did try that for a period in the 80s of having interaction of legislatures from all parties. Other federations do that, notably the German, some of that in the German Federation. So we have to diminish executive federalism as the exclusive way of developing agreements among the provinces and use the full parliamentary committee approach a little more. That's all I can say, Mary.
So we've talked a little bit about youth engagement and people not sort of being involved in the political process. And my question is, in times of crisis when there's fear and people look at the political sphere and they see sort of people arguing about who has the right to act and who doesn't and who should be in charge of everything, and yet people are losing their jobs or there's a crisis in health, I think part of maybe not engaging is the fact that the fear isn't being responded to effectively, that people don't, like, who's speaking up for the people who are worried about losing their jobs and all of this. So if the politicians are speaking partisan terms and the media is, everyone can trust the media to sort of overrule everything, who is being reassuring. This is why, Dr. Couillard, when you spoke about being reassuring, I think it's incredibly important. And I'm wondering who plays that role, who responds, and who can be trusted to respond. I think when citizens have a better idea of that, of who they go to in times of crisis, who they can trust, then you're going to have more engagement because they're going to be more interested in who those people are going to be. And so I'm wondering which body, maybe in Dr. Couillard, when you've been dealing with crisis, who do you think is capable of taking on this role of getting through all the partisanship and speaking to what people are scared about?
Thank you for your comment. I was asked a few weeks ago after leaving politics if I missed anything in Fox. What I didn't miss, what I don't miss is the partisan bickering and the media environment. What I miss is the opportunity to take action, participate in societal evolution. When crisis arises, and maybe I could refer to Mr. Russell's comment about my earlier comments, and I said we shrug off the crisis. But I think the population is responsible enough now to listen to a political who would say on prime time, the evening of the crisis erupts, I'm there, we need to take care of it with everyone. Everybody's going to have a voice, but to take a decision. There has to be someone at the end of the day that makes a decision. And have the courage also to tell people, looking at them in the eyes, I don't know yet. Here's the problem. I would name the problem. Here are the main things we need to discuss and reflect upon. Of course, in certain situations, you don't have the time to do this. When 9/11 happened in the U.S., it's a totally different situation. But most of the crises do not have this magnitude of this degree of urgency. I personally think the Canadian public is sure enough now to listen to political message and concentrate the substance and the ideas and principles that have to be debated without rushing to a conclusion in order to distance yourself from your opponents. But maybe I'm dreaming here. Last comment about what I heard about the question of both federal and provincial governments being minority situations. My view is that in Quebec we have a particular problem with this because both the federal parliament and here we have parties who do not live in our country. So it makes the discussion extremely complex, let me tell you, when you try to have this type of engagement and relationship. This is the whole issue that we're not discussing here, obviously. But coming back to what you said, I think people are waiting for a new political message. It's quite apparent now with the U.S. election. They are waiting to see a political leader that will talk in other terms that does narrow partisan message. I think the population is ready to hear that. They will reward that person with electoral support. But maybe I'm dreaming again.
No. I just want to add a point. I think the demand for political leadership is extraordinarily high, and that's part of the positive reaction to Obama in the early days, and candor seems to carry a lot of credibility. I would distinguish confidence from trust. Confidence about the future and the positive message that Mr. Flaherty gave us, for instance, that, yes, we will get through this and we're strong and all of that, as opposed to trust in the leadership that they're taking the issue seriously, which is what I think the restaurants that you were talking about, Philippe, is that I think they're slightly different and we need to come back to that. And the third point is just on science. There's a role for explication of scientists to the public on some complex issues that arise in the health area, but I'm thinking of SARS here, where the role of the chief medical officer in Toronto was extraordinarily important in giving people confidence that the issue was being dealt with. Not that she had the answer, but that she was able to deal with it. The collapse of the ground fishery in the East, where the scientists explained it, and Wendy Thompson mentioned the old scientific advisor in talking to the public about why they had to close the footpaths in the foot and mouth case. So there's some interesting questions about who is the custodian of truth and confidence.
I think it's very important to convince the public that you're not just pushing it in a partisan way, to include people, leaders from other parties, important people from other parties, in your addressing the problem. We've watched Mr. Obama do that. It's been extraordinary help to him and building the confidence of the American people. I know he didn't convince all Republicans. He reached out and he kept some of them in his administration. I thought our government, the better in Afghanistan, reached out and allowed a debate in the House of Commons in the spring of 2006. I said it wouldn't have a debate. It reached out. The Liberals were split, but it brought some important Liberals, including Bill Graham and John Manley on side, and then the Manley Committee was a more or less multi-partisan kind of overview task force on Afghanistan. That broadened. I think people saw this is a government that's not just trying to sell a partisan point of view of Afghanistan. It's reaching out. And with that goes, and I love what Philippe says, some real modesty about
the government having all, not having all the answers. You know, if you dig in and you say, yeah, hell, we know what we're doing and we're going to do this, well, you haven't got room to listen and take anyone else forward. So I think Obama has brought in quite a few people to give him advice. He has not said all the answers, and it's been part of his appeal, his modesty.
We've got time, I think, we have 5 minutes, so we have time for more questions and brief answers, not television brief answers, but relatively brief answers in the middle.
Thank you very much. My question is for Mr. Russell, and first I'd like to salute you. How colorful and reasonable you can be. And if we want to trigger your revolution, I'm wondering, apart from the record performance of yours, how do we do? Before the prorogation debate, I heard your colleagues from the Assemblée Laval saying that perhaps there could be a reference question, which would be highly controversial because it is based partly on convention. But do you think the court should step in eventually, even if it's undemocratic, they have a lot of public support? And the second thing is, I know you worked a lot on central agencies. Should we keep pointing fingers at close people to the prime minister, as Mr. Kim Kopp said before? Sometimes when you're relying on close advisors, produces bad outcomes. Do you think the opposition parties should, you know, say perhaps it's not that accountable? Would that you think that this would trigger public support, that people care about it? So I mean, what's your plan in a way?
not quite clear on your last point. Maybe you could just clarify a little bit. You want this?
Okay. We'll move on to another question.
Well, I can answer that in the usual ambiguous way, Bill. I just don't want to see the courts becoming the umpire of the unwritten part of our Constitution. Can you imagine a Governor General, the Prime Minister goes and asks for a dissolution, and the Governor General says, well, I don't know. We're going to have a reference case in the Supreme Court. The arguments will begin in 3 months. And besides, there's no special knowledge on the part of the judges of the Supreme Court, and even more on these parts of our Constitution. Even more important, this is the part of our Constitution. This here are the rules of parliamentary democracy. And what powers are left for the Governor General in a constitutional democracy such as ours? This has to be done by the people and their leaders. This is political stuff. We don't want to turn this into a technical legal argument before any court. So I'd be dead against pulling the courts into this.
Final question? See ahead in the back, Jeremy.
Jeremy Leonard of the Institute for Research on Public Policy. It's a question for Monsieur Couillard à propos of the Shaoui decision. And I'm circling back to the first session about evidence-based, because I was interested to hear that it was a surprise decision. But the think tank, like the IP and many others, what the decision implied was that there needed to be some private in the system, that we were not in a bipolar Canada's perfect, the U.S. is garbage, and there's nothing in between. And there's been more than a decade and a half of policy research about different options, looking at various options in other countries they might apply to Canada. And I'm just interested, as a matter of process, to what degree that research becomes institutional knowledge in the ministry. In other words, are they in the bottom drawer somewhere? So when you reacted to this surprise, to the extent to which you were drawing on evidence-based propositions. Thank you.
Thank you. First, you have to make a political judgment on what your values are before going into evidence and scientific papers and academic debates. What you believe in, and we do believe, and I believe in the values of solidarity and sharing, and you know, sharing bird disease. I don't believe that the state was the only way to deal with this, though, and keep these values open. This being said, when we had debate, we did look at evidence, and as you say, many OECD research show the effect and the impact of our unregulated or less than well-regulated private healthcare, or private paid healthcare in access to the general public. So there was a deep concern in my part and in the government's part that opening the system to private pay or private insurance in the context of medical manpower shortage, for example, or nursing shortage, could be extremely detrimental to the interest of the larger majority or the larger public. So we wanted to avoid this at all costs. But remember, this was an area, a time of mortal danger. Because if the decision had been just to do nothing, then day one, the articles had been completely eliminated from the legislative body, and you could offer private insurance all the board, across the board of the care that is offered to citizens. So there was a deliberate choice to improve access mainly through public pay, and again, mainly through public institutions, but also with private providers under public pay, which was there present already, but not regulated. This is the big mistake of commentators about Bill 33 and the response of government to Jolie. It did not create any new things. It just recognized what the landscape was and regulated it, while correctly values again and the principles that should govern our healthcare. And I would just, and I don't want to start a healthcare debate here today, we would spend the whole day doing this, but we have to differentiate the values of the system. Values is what we all believe in, we share, solidarity, etc. And I think these are very good values to protect. The system is a way to express these values. So you'll always be ready to transform the system in order to adapt to what happens in society. And what has been happening in our country, unfortunately, is that people have been confusing both, and they have put the sacred value system more sometimes than on its values. So this is what we had in mind, and yes, we used evidence based mainly prison health policy, health economics, and OECD to direct our choices.
Thank you very much. Please join me in thanking the panel for a terrific session.
Thank you, Bill.
Thank you to our panelists.
Merci beaucoup à tous. Je vous invite maintenant à vous rendre au déjeuner qui va vous servir ici au main lobby à côté. J'en profite pour vous rappeler le prochain panel débutera exactement à 14h, 2 p.m. We're back here. Lunch will be served right next door in the main lobby and in the heritage room behind it. They're all lined up for the buffet, so do spread out as much as possible. And do remember that we will reassemble just before 2 p.m. for this afternoon panel. We'll be talking about how many cooks are in the kitchen, which is a good talk after lunch, and of course, the role of media and public opinion. Thanks very much.